Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to a virtual trip to the island of Jamaica. We are going to be pretending that we are under our favorite tree, in our favorite chair, feeling the trade winds blow softly across your face. So for those of you who might be in a cold country or in a hot city or right there on the island of Jamaica, we want to welcome you and to just have you relax with us for the next hour here in the backyard. When we labrish, we're always reminiscing about things we remember or things we are discovering, because our objective is to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And for those of us who still love it, but we're not there, we just love to get together in the backyard and talk about things we didn't have time to check out while we were growing up, or things that we remember. So I thank you for spending this time with me and hope that you'll enjoy our topic of the evening, because I have memories of some of this stuff, so it's really tickling my fancy this evening. I think we've been having some rather interesting shows about things that happened long ago, but we can always relate in some way to how they can affect us today, how they're like, they can help us to understand who we are as just members of the universe, but especially descendants of Jamaica. So, with that said, I am going, for those of you who are on my list, you know that today, by the way, today is the 27th of October, 2010. You know, these shows are archived in cyberspace, so hopefully long after we're gone, the younger generation that might be interested in Jamaican culture will be checking us out on cyberspace. So this evening we're going to be talking about the Gibraltar camp during the 1940s when England was at war. So for people who might not quite know where Gibraltar is, I am going to give you some information from Wikipedia. So just bear with me now while I get that information for you. But I see that we have quite a few callers this evening, and I want to welcome everybody to the show and ask you to bear with me here. It's thunderstorming in my city. And although we had a very dreary day today, I suppose we're getting some backlash from some of the weather that's going on now. But let me just fill you in for our visitors that might not know a thing about Gibraltar or where it is or why Jamaica was involved with it. I'd like to give you a little information. Apparently, you know, I didn't even know this before I researched it on the internet, but Gibraltar was considered one of the pillars of Hercules. So it goes back, I mean, people has been inhabiting that rock for a long, long time because it was given to certain Spanish kings and queens, and eventually it landed up in the hands of Britain, and that's why Jamaica was involved with it. But I see here in my notes, and I always encourage historians or people who love history, history fans, to go check these things out because everything is on the internet. But the story that I'm going to tell you related to Jamaica tonight is brought to us by Dr. Tortello from Pieces of the Past, which is published in the Jamaican Gleaner. But anyway, let me go back to Wikipedia here, because I was surprised to see that at one point in the history, it traces the history from going back from 950 BCE and all the different factors that inhabited the rock at that one time or another. But in 1474, a group of Jewish people bought it from one of the kings the Duke of Meridian, who owned it then in 1472. So he sold it to a group of 4,350 Jewish people, and it was part that they had to maintain it for 2 years. As a matter of fact, they maintained it for 2 years. But he took it back from them and threw them off. I mean, this is so funny. In 1704, during the War of the Spanish Succession, a combination of Anglo-Dutch force acquired the town of Gibraltar. This is after the Spanish Duke took it back from the Jewish people. He actually threw them out. It says here that they were expelled 2 years after they bought it. So I'm just saying that to say, you know, all of this business used to go on long ago. You know, people make a commitment, then they change their mind. I mean, whether they're in government or in private practice, it's funny how as humans the behavior hasn't changed much. Anyway, back to the article. It was given to Britain by Spain in 1727. So they have owned it for a long time. Needless to say, Spain is still trying to get it back. But from what it says here, that the Gibraltarians do not want to be owned by Spain. So they have voted almost 100% to remain under British rule. Well, not rule, because they self-govern themselves. So let's get to the article of how Jamaica came into the picture. So we now know that Britain owned the rock. It's called the Gib, or the rock. And this is how we came into the picture. And I want you all to just picture this in your mind, because, you know, Jamaicans have always been known to be friendly and entertaining and welcoming, and I am sure we still are. But this really stood out to me. As we read the article, you will see what I'm talking about. But a lot of times when we think about what's happening now, we tend to forget that basically at the core of just everybody, but especially Jamaicans, we're always welcoming and helpful. So I'm going to go on to the story as it's written by Dr. Tortello in Pieces of the Past. As quiet and unassuring as the Gibraltar Camp Road section of the UWI campus is today, years ago it was anything but. The site of an evacuation camp for some 1,500 Gibraltarians, hence its name, an army base, and later an internment camp, the land was covered by rows after rows of wooden huts with a few condos here or there. In 1940, the English gave orders to establish an evacuation camp for anywhere between 7,000 to 9,000 war-threatened civilian inhabitants of their Mediterranean colonies, Gibraltar and Malta. Located at the entrance of the Mediterranean, the Straits of Gibraltar, which links the Mediterranean Sea and the North Atlantic Ocean, are found on the southern coast of Spain. Malta is located in the middle of the Mediterranean, halfway between Sicily and North America. So now I think listeners get a picture of really where it is, sort of in the middle of all these countries. It's actually borders Africa and Spain and part of the Suez Canal. So I think that because of its strategic location, it was very, very important to whether England would win the war or, you know, could really operate effectively. And from what I see in the Wikipedia accounts is that it was fortunate that at that time the dictator Franco in France did not like the Germans. So, you know, it was, if he did, then it would have been a problem. So he was instrumental in having, in helping Britain to secure the rock. So they had to get everybody out of there so they could use it strategically in the war. So people, they were dispersing the inhabitants to different people, so to different places. So actually, they were making arrangements for between 7,000 to 9,000 of people, for people from Malta and Gibraltar to come to Jamaica. Now, that didn't pan out exactly because less than that came, but I'm going to go on with the article. Now, it goes on to say that it was Gibraltar was ceded to through a treaty in 1704 to Britain, which I mentioned before. Now, let me get back to the article. I must apologize that I'm a little scattered tonight because our light's been going on and off, so you know how it is when you're in bad weather, so please forgive me. Now, the then Mona Estate was considered an ideal location for a refugee camp because at that time it was government property, spacious enough and located close to Kingston. The Public Works Department spent £375,000 clearing the site, putting in roads, constructing barracks, stores and offices, as well as a police station, a hospital, and cottages for senior staff, and a Roman Catholic nun and priest who would monitor the refugees. So they had housing for everybody. Now, Major General Bob Nish recalls hearing that many of the barracks' frames were constructed on board ships en route to Jamaica, which accelerated the building process immeasurably. I suppose they couldn't trust them to build it fast enough in Jamaica. That's my sidebar. The wooden barracks stood in long rows. They measured, they gave the measurements, which you don't need to have, but from what I see here, they weren't very big, 25 feet wide and 7 foot long. No, they had 7 foot verandas. Now, upon completion, the camp's 252 acres was enclosed by a wire fence. It had water, electricity, and a telephone service were also provided. Now, I just thought it strange how they had telephone service at that time, and I remember when I moved back to Jamaica in 1970, I could not get a phone because there were not enough phone lines. Isn't that something? When you need to have something, you can have it right away. But I suppose in those days, I remember they had the Morse code. But I'm wondering if any of the listeners on the board remember any of this when they were living in Jamaica or growing up then. But when I'm finished with the article, I'm going to tell you of my memories. Now, the first set of 1,104 Gibraltarians, 185 men and 673 women and 246 children arrived by ship on October 1940. This is the part I like. Thousands of Jamaicans turned out to welcome them, punctuating their bus trip to the camp with cheers. One of these was young Jackie Thuris, who remembers how, as a Boy Scout, his troop turned out to help guide the Gibraltarians on their way. A second group of 393 arrived in November. By that point, all men over 45 and all women, regardless of age, were ordered to leave Gibraltar. Now I'm going to go to the sidebar and I'll come back to the article. Some time ago, I think our fan from the Bronx and I discussed an article that we were talking about then was when the Japanese were evacuated from their homes right here in America and they were put in barracks. Now, I remember as a youngster growing up, going on the bus up to Hope Pastures, I think it was called at the time, and I would see people behind the barbed wire fence. And I remember as a child, it was really sort of scary. I remember seeing the men without shirts, some of them without shirts, and they were so tanned, you know, because I suppose they weren't accustomed to the sun. I don't know if they were these people, but I remember that all of that activity in the 1940s when I was at just a kid and going on the bus. And I'm wondering if anyone on the board has any memories or have any of their people tell them about any of this, if they knew all of this that was going on. Because I know that perhaps we have always had GLENA, so a lot of this perhaps was being publicized. I know I was too young to understand or perhaps care, but I'm wondering if anybody on the board would like to join the labrish on that. Anybody? Any hands going up? All right. Well, I suppose you don't go back as far as I do. But let me go back to Dr. Tortella's article. Now, the Maltese never came in large numbers. A delegation that visited the island was said not to have liked it, and they did not wish their families to be placed under the rule of black and colored people. So isn't that something? Now, the Gibraltarians had plenty of room. They were living in a camp meant for 7,000. After much discussion, some of the extra space was used by Jewish European refugees following special appeal to the British Empire. 153 arrived in 1942, and 107 more came later. That is the Jewish refugees they're referring to. The number of Gibraltarians grew during their stay in Jamaica as over 100 babies were born in the camp. So I'm just wondering if they were considered Jamaicans because they were born there. Doesn't say if they were given birth certificates or anything like that. But I'm just curious. Now, Peter McCauley, a mess officer with the West Indian Regiment stationed at Gibraltar Camp at that time, recalls that residents could come and go between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. once they logged in and out. Soldiers, in parenthesis, McCauley explained, could leave on a 1159 pass. That must be the name of the pass because they could perhaps leave it something to do with 1159. At the end of the war in 1944, let me go to page 2. Sorry about that. And that's on 3. Okay, here I am on 2. The pass name for the time they were to be back. Whatever time they left, they had to come back by 11:59 before the stroke of midnight, I suppose. Jamaicans entering the camp without passes could, however, be fined. The camp was first run by the English Commodore, Major Henry Sims, whose residence is one of few buildings from that era still standing. It remains on Gibraltar Camp Road near the Poppine entrance and currently houses the offices of the University of the West Indies Development Foundation. So there is some artifacts of this happening in Jamaica. I'm just wondering if any of this history is known by even the students at the university, or if any of this that we are being enlightened about is being taught as part of Jamaican history in the schools. And there again, if anybody on the board know, please let me know, because I'm not really plugged into what the curriculum is like now for the students. So please, this is a library, so do fill this old senior in on some of how this connects. Because I think, 1944 is quite recent, at least for me it's quite recent. I was born in 1935, so I was like 5, perhaps I wasn't 5 years old when I remember, but 6, perhaps 6 or 7, because they were there for a little while. But let me go back here. It's not a very lot of information, because as I can tell, all the historians who's doing this collection of data for us, they're just piecing things together from, I suppose, news articles or people remembering events, just like Dr. Joy Lumsden does. She comes across some information and she tried to cross-reference it somewhere else and seek documents all over the place. So if that's why it's so good for people to tell their stories. If anyone on the board know anything further about anybody telling them of anything that was happening, it would be mostly Kingstonians, I suppose, because this all took place in Kingston, and I don't know how much the other parts of the island were involved in the movement, because, of course, we were a British colony then. Now, there's a comment here from a Jewish refugee, Miriam Stanton, who came to Gibraltar camp as a young girl. Now, she was one of the refugees. She says, it was a bustling and lively little town. We had with the Dutch refugees over 3,000 people living in a refugee section of Gibraltar camp and about 1,000 employees working there. We were completely self-sufficient. We had schools, a hospital, shops, offices, a police station, even a lockup. There were always something happening. Concerts, weddings, fights, scandals, and unfortunately, funerals as well. We had beautiful gardens. Everyone tended his own little patch. And that was something she quoted here from a publication, a comment from a Jewish refugee. Now, she goes on to note that there were churches and a room to be used as a synagogue, as well as a kosher kitchen. Each room had an army cot, chair, and a table. Those refugees who had a trade were allowed to work within the camp, which translated into payment for the hairdresser, barber, shoemaker, tailor, and others. Books, newspapers, and radios were available. There was never a shortage of food. Yet, some Jewish refugees have sad memories of the camp, charging a lack of interest among the local Jewish community, despite the fact that certain individuals within the community did extend a welcome. This lack of interest may be as a result of the fact that the refugees were of a different, you know, sect than the Jews there in Jamaica, and they did not speak English. And the Jamaican Jews were, I suppose that is why they were not warming up to them, because they were different. Now, sidebar again. You know, even among people of the same religion, there can be, you know, feelings of resentment or not friendly. We think now that some of the things we experience in whatever cities we live is strange or, you know, it's all, I'm not saying it's wrong or right, but I just find a lot of these historical stories to be similar to what's happening now. You know, people within the same faith, or, you know, industry or profession not feeling welcome by their peers. And here it was happening in the 40s among these Jewish people. You know, some people was fine with it and other people considered it a problem. Now, let me get back to the article. In the late 1943, a section of Gibraltar camp near today's Mona Rehabilitation Center was run by the military as a family internment center for Italians and Germans previously housed at Upper Camp and Hanover Street. Men were held one place and women were held somewhere else. These internees mainly came from British West Africa. They had been working there as tradesmen when the war broke out and they were shipped to Sierra Leone, the Gold Coast of Nigeria, and later Jamaica. So we were housing at that same time people from Italians and Germans. Now, a German from Cameroon, British West Africa, remembers that his family was one of the last set of internees to leave the Gibraltar camp. Although 7 years old when he left Jamaica, his name is Zitzow, remembers there were probably about 60 families in the camp, mostly professional Germans and Italians. construction workers and missionaries who had been interned in British West Africa during the war. The families were housed in 8 barracks, and there were also a dining hall, school, and staff quarters. His father raised rabbits in their yard and built a community oven, baking breads and cakes. There were a sports field, and each month movies were shown. Plays and concerts were staged every now and then, and the children were taken on field trips. Now, by the end of 1943, Gibraltar Camp employed 186 local staff and 446 evacuee staff. There were 1,530 Gibraltarians, as well as some Spanish evacuees, Polish and Dutch refugees, and a few Finnish internees. When the war was over, Zitzo recalls that most internees returned to Germany and Italy, although some married Jamaicans and stayed. As for Zitzo, he moved with his family to the Dominican Republic, where his father worked at a chocolate factory, and eventually to the United States. And this she's quoting from another publication. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock. My name is Margaret Marshall. I'm the host of the show. What I do, just for the passion of it, I research things that I didn't know about when I was growing up about my beautiful island and my culture, and I talk about it here each week, hoping that people who have a love for culture, a love for Jamaica, they might be Jamaicans or foreigners, will welcome these stories, as I do, because I am just thrilled when I read of stories of survival, of perseverance, of success, of, you know, just keeping on. And I find it very inspiring. It makes me very proud when I know that it's people from Jamaica, born on the island. And what I'm thinking here now is that how it must be to be just uprooted from your house, not because you choose to, because a lot of Jamaicans choose to be where they are today, and whether they go for one thing or another. But can you imagine being uprooted from your house, from your country, and taken to a totally different place where you know no one, and how that must feel, and to know that the Jamaicans then were so welcoming to people they didn't know. I am sure a lot of them didn't even know where Gibraltar was, let alone know what the people looked like or were like. So, you know, it's strange to find out. It's not strange, but as we dig into history, we find out that humans are humans, no matter what part of the world they are. There are going to be, I'm sure there were some people there at the time where couldn't care less, or they might have been resenting it. But there were people there who went to welcome these people that they didn't know anything about, but just to make them feel good. They were singing and cheering and welcoming them to the island. And really, that really, really makes me proud. So let me just read you the last page on this. And I think my favorite fan from the Bronx, home of the Yankees, have some additional information to share about Gibraltar with us tonight. I hope he's on the board. So would you please put up your hands if you are, sir. Yes, he's on the board. I'll open up the mic to you in a minute. I just want to close this out with a couple more notes from Dr. Tortella's article. And I really encourage my listeners to check out the different stories on Pieces of the Past when you do have time, we have brought a lot of them to life here on Backyard Labrish. And I hope you find it enlightening and interesting. And I'm always trying to relate it to, you know, what's happening in the world now as we speak, and how as humans we are going to find behavior that is welcoming and resentful. The thing about it is that when you're coming from the heart, you do what is right for you, and you just know that whatever the challenges are, you can overcome them. Because I can imagine if I had to be uprooted from my house. Well, I was at one time because my house burned down, and I know how that felt. But can you imagine just being told that you have to get out to go to another country that you know nothing about? So anyway, go back to the article. At the end of the war in 1944, the Gibraltarians, by then numbered close to 2,000, and it said that they left on a big ship, didn't even know the name of the ship. Those who had married Jamaicans simply took their wives with them. Jamaican historian Hartley Nater recalls that when the time of departure came, Gibraltarian women paid their last visit to Papin Market, where they received many hugs from the Jamaicans who were sad to see them go. Upon their safe return, the governor of Gibraltar sent a letter thanking the Jamaican people, noting that the Gibraltarians remembered that Jamaica gave them sanctuary and made them welcome. Many of the Jewish refugees left for Cuba and other destinations, although some moved to the nunnery until they could find permanent homes. So I am assuming that that meant that they stayed in Jamaica. Now, following the end of the war, the colonial office closed down the camp, and a part of it was used as an ex-serviceman's training school until 1947, when the camp buildings and some 650 acres of the combined Papin and Mona estate were handed over to form the new University College of the West Indies. Some of the old Gibraltar camp buildings have been converted, such as the present personnel office, which was once part of the Gibraltar camp dining room. Others, such as the aforementioned commandant and deputy commandant's bungalows, the camp recreational hall turned campus dramatic theater, and the old library remains fairly intact. So the Mona Rehabilitation Center, located near the UWI, and the Gibraltar Camp Bell, used to signal meals and gatherings, are now part of the UWI's new sculpture park and also reminders of bygone days. Now, chances are that not many Jamaicans know much about Gibraltar Camp or Gibraltar, but Peter McCauley believes that Gibraltarians remember Jamaica. Towards the end of our interview, McCauley recounted how a few years ago, when he and his wife Dawn visited Gibraltar, they wound up with a taxi driver who, on hearing where they came from, excitedly told them that his grandparents had come to Jamaica during World War II. He said that Jamaica held a special place in their heart. There were other internment camps in Jamaica during World War II. Upa Camp, for example, there was a prisoner of war, which is POW, camp was where German and Italian prisoners, mainly sea merchants, were held. Now, you don't know how happy I was when I read that, because I had memories in my head, although I was quite small, I had memories of hearing that these men I would see over the fence half naked, no shirt on, red as a tomato. They were like digging ditches, I think, but they were working. And I remember hearing that they were prisoners of war. And I remember saying that to some people that were younger than me, of course, at different periods, and they were saying, what are you talking about? You know, and I even questioned myself and said, you know, did I make it up? Was it from a movie? So when I read this, I was rejuvenated because I know I have clear memories of seeing those men, and I remember my mother or my father telling me that they were prisoners of war. So let me open up the mic now. I think this is my loyal listener from the Bronx. Good evening. This is Margaret in the backyard, fumbling our way through because my lights are going on and off. So who do I have? Good evening.
This is Lay from the Bronx, the home of the former champion Yankees.
Oh, they're not the champions anymore.
Say no more.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about Gibraltar.
Well,
are you familiar
know,
with any of this? Do you have memories of any of this?
Yes, I do. What you just pointed out about the prisoner of war situation, the POW. I remember vividly. You know, we used to go up to the barbed wire fence, and some of them would come over and talk to us, or try to talk to us. And,
did you know then that they were prisoners?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I know, but a lot of younger Jamaicans don't know that.
No, they wouldn't know. Just as you know, they probably wouldn't know that much about Gibraltar, except that it should be a footnote in history, and even to show that Jamaica had some direct contribution to the war right there on our own soil. Of course, we had sent servicemen to join the war campaign. We sent RAF boys, you know, Royal Air Force boys.
Oh, yes, I remember that. One of my uncles went and never came back.
Yeah,
so I remember vividly. I remember him, you know, leaving. I really remember that.
He had pilots that were trained in Canada and went to England. And as you say, some did not return.
Right. Well. Some, even if they weren't killed, they stayed in England.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
And don't forget, in those days, we were British subjects.
Of course, yes. But, you know, speaking of that, I remember during the time of the war when we would have the air raid, the siren go off.
Yeah.
And we would have to put out all the lights.
Right.
And I remember that things were rationed. We had a ration book.
My father.
Whether you had
war.
Money or not, you could only buy X amount of milk because everything was imported.
Yeah.
So,
I
remember vividly the camp scene.
Yeah. You know, I was about to say my father was a warden and put on his helmet.
Oh, he was one of those that knocked on the fence and tell you to put the lights out?
Bet, yeah.
Oh, so they had them in every neighborhood, because I remember that. You know, I used to be so terrified because I was afraid of the dark. And I remember my mother had a candle or a little lamp at one time, hiding it someplace. And some man came and almost knocked down the door. She had to put it out. I don't know how they would have seen that little light, but they did.
Yeah, they would, yeah.
And I remember I was terrified.
Okay. Getting back on the subject of Gibraltar, you know, like in any campaign, I'm a World War II buff. I have hundreds of reams of film of war movies. But strangely enough, there was nothing on the Gibraltar attachment. I suppose Gibraltar actually was a very strategic.
Oh, yes.
And the story that we are now finding out about was that the Germans had their eyes on Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Spain and Britain were concerned that they might overrun Gibraltar and take it over. So if this were to happen, they had made preparations to have a team of soldiers stay back in secret to spy on the Germans.
The Germans.
Now it's coming out that this was called Operation Tracer.
Uh-huh.
And more recently called the Stay Behind Caves, because they found caves, and this is now a big tourist attraction in Gibraltar, where they would show them these caves. There were several of them, but this one in particular was top secret, and they just discovered an individual of six men who were supposed to stay back in the caves. And this was...
You mean after the evacuation?
After the evacuation, if that had...
Ah.
And he was a doctor, as well as a lieutenant, in the regiment that was assigned there. And
it's British. They were British soldiers.
Yes. And they had this secret cave, and it was... If the Germans had taken over it, the cave would be sealed, and they would have provisions there to keep them alive or...
Forever?
Yeah, for a year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And,
interesting.
They even had a bicycle in case they were able to get out and roam the survey the area. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you can imagine that a secret location like that would entail. They
interesting.
Had, yeah, they had it. So these people that are in charge of this place now were not sure if this indeed was the one of the caves, the main one that we're talking about that was secret, until
uh-huh.
they found Dr. Bruce Cooper.
Uh-huh.
And at the time that they found him, he was 92, I think. Yes, 92 years old. And they even wondered if his memory would hold up to validate that this particular cave that they're now showing people was the stay behind cave that they had a whole spiel on but really didn't know the reality of the situation. So he shed a lot of light, Miss Dr. Cooper, on this cave. And they're supposed to come out with a movie, which I hope they do soon, because I would like to see, you know, behind the scenes what went on there. Of course, it was top secret and still is. So they have to dig up this information before they're able to complete this movie. But
mm-hmm.
it's intriguing, you know, to see. Even just the other day they had in England people who had survived the First World War and the Second World War, and there were just a handful of people left.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, this and the information is going to die out with the last one to survive.
Right, the true story, and then you have people having to make up stories and try to piece things together.
Except in this case, this doctor was able to shed light on, you know, what really went on in this cave, and as I said, validate that this was one of the Tracer operation caves. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. And you know, I'm telling you, as this article says, I doubt a lot of Jamaicans know about this. You know, this going on in 1940. Even some Jamaicans that might have been in Jamaica at the time, like, you know, in the country parts.
Yeah.
Well, would, not,
as you said before, that the people in Kingston probably had some idea, only because they some of the people in these compounds were visible to them.
Right, but I don't think there was a lot of publicity about exactly what was going on at the time.
No.
Because, you know, because the war was going on. So a lot of things were done secretly.
Yeah.
But it's just so, it's, I find all of this information just so interesting. And as I say, there are always stories that, you know, from the past that you can relate to now. And I do hope that somehow, if it's not done, but it will be considered to integrate some of this information to the now generation of Jamaicans. Because I think that the more the young people know about the important part that they, as Jamaicans, or Jamaica itself, and all its inhabitants played in different periods of time in the entire world. Because, you know, just the fact that the Britain had a place, at least that the people could come and, you know, do their thing, be away from, they all went back. From all I read, you know, they all went back to their where they came from, and it's not Jamaica alone that welcomed them. They went to other parts, some part of England and someplace else. However,
other parts of the Caribbean as well.
Right, right. So the point is that I think the more we know about our past, that can strengthen our confidence. Is the more, you know, self-esteem the young people will have, because it seems like, not all of them, but a lot of them are sort of lost. And perhaps that's why things are not going as well as they should. And I try not to get into politics or religion or anything like that, but I'm just trying to, and I wish I knew more about what is going on currently in the educational system and what is being taught and, you know, referenced. I'm sure at the university level, like people doing history and all that, possibly have it because it's right in the Gleaner. I mean, in pieces of the past in the Gleaner. But I find now that the younger generation, or the next generation, is just perhaps as I was during my time, busy with their kids and busy with, you know, just life, that they really don't have the time to, you know, do research and do, unless it's their passion or unless they're doing a project or a paper. And that's why I am hoping that bringing these stories alive by just talking about them, because people can be listening as they're doing their email or, you know, just surfing the net or something else. They can listen to the stories on Backyard Labrish. And that, with that said, I want to thank our loyal listeners for spreading the word, because we are getting downloaded a lot faster and more times than we were before. So it means that people are telling other people, and they are hopefully sending the links to particular shows that may be of interest to their peers or their friends or their family. And I encourage them to visit backyardlabrish.com and leave us a comment or send us an email if they're listening online, because you can listen on your computer. And all of our shows are archived. And it's interesting to see that the shows that get the most hits, and it's the ones that, you know, are from way back and that are intriguing. And pretty soon I'll be doing, once a month I plan to do, this is one of the ideas I have, and I'm always open for ideas. I ask the listeners to let me know what they want to hear. You know, it's everybody's backyard that love Jamaica and have a passion for history, or, you know, that when we labrish, we get together to talk about a subject of interest to all of us. So if you have a subject you would like us to discuss and it relates to Jamaican culture and something we can celebrate, something that will enlighten and something we want to preserve, then I'd be more than happy to welcome this story and you. You can tell your story yourself, or if you want me to tell it for you, I'm more than happy, although I'm fumbling my way through sometimes. I have to ask my audience to forgive me because I'm a senior citizen, senior, as I call myself. Not only that, but I have medical issues that I have to take care of. Sometimes in the middle of a broadcast, I'm diabetic, so I will get a low and my head start going funny. For people with diabetes out there, you might know what I'm talking about. And I have to go grab some orange juice or something's going on. So I am so grateful that everybody has been patient with me. I'm not so patient with myself sometimes. But because I am so passionate about doing this, and I am retired, I have the time, I absolutely love it. I love finding out stories about what things used to be like, and I encourage seniors or anybody with a story to come share it with us, because you would be surprised how interesting. You might not think it's interesting, but it might be interesting to a lot of other people. So, Mr. Lay, do you have anything else to add?
Yes, just for the sake of accuracy for your history buffs, in your opening remarks about Gibraltar, you mentioned that a treaty handed over Gibraltar in 1704. Now, this was one of the things that we all got in history. Way back then, it's 1713, the Treaty of Utrecht.
Yes, I got my dates mixed up.
Is a treaty that ceded in perpetuity Gibraltar to Britain from Spain. Spain must have hated that they ever did that, because they tried many times and
still trying
to get it back. But, you know, it's not going to happen.
But the point is this, that the people don't want to be...
No, they had referenda. The people don't want it. They want to stay with the British.
But they're self-governing, from what I read. You know, they elect their own people and all of that. And it's similar to what goes on in Jamaica, I think, because, you know, it's the queen is recognized as the head, but she is not really making any laws.
Yeah. The difference is that we are, as Jamaican, Jamaica is independent, and Gibraltar remains a territory of Britain, and
a colony.
Yeah.
What is the difference? I see a hand up. What is the difference between a territory and a colony?
Colonies went out back in, I think, 1960, but there were a couple of acts that changed certain countries in the Commonwealth nations from the status of colonies to...
Oh, so it's just a change in the word.
Essentially. And main is that most of the territories still maintain British citizenship.
Oh, I got you. All right. I see a hand up in 631451. I'm going to open up the mic. Good evening. This is Margaret in the backyard. We're labrishing. Who do I have?
Hi, Margaret. This is Janine from Long Island.
Hi, Janine from Long Island. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great.
I just want to say, I remember growing up as a child, I always heard the saying, you're as strong as the rock of Gibraltar.
Yes. I've heard
hearing
that.
I remember hearing
it. I just thought it was a phrase.
No.
They would use it a lot, you know.
Yes.
And I'm sure I heard things about it, but to be honest, I can't remember anything.
So you don't remember any of the campaign?
You're right about that, Janine. Gibraltar is actually a fortress.
Right.
Uh-huh. Right.
And as you said, Madge, you're going way back.
Hercules.
Yes, way back, it was a fortress that if you had that, you could win any war.
Right. I remember hearing that saying a lot, you know. And I'm sure I heard a little thing about it, but to be honest, I was so young at the time that maybe I didn't really pay too much attention. But now that I'm listening to you, you know, it's like a little of it kind of ring a bell a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was told in my time, you know, by the older people. But, of course, during that time, we really didn't pay much attention to things like that, so.
Right. But it's interesting because I know I remembered, you know, the scene. I mean, the scene is vivid in my mind, I suppose, because it was so unusual to see those people working behind the fence.
Right.
And then, you know, as I grew up as a teenager and when I came here first and I would mention things, I would sometimes wonder if it was a movie I saw or if it was, you know, I'm making it up.
Yes.
So when I come across information like this piece that, you know, sort of states it, I just have a real good feeling that I was making it up. So if there's anyone else on the board that would like to join the Labrish, please do so by hitting 1 on your telephone, and then that lets me know that you're putting up your hand, and I will open up the mic for you. So if you'd like to join the Labrish before we have a couple of minutes left, please let us know. So I found an interesting piece online that I wanted to, or I got it in an email someplace, that I wanted to share with everybody, because we're getting into the season where, you know, we are asked to give and share, you know, before you know it, Christmas will be here.
Right.
Once Halloween, you know, right after that, as a matter of fact, here in my city, even it's not Halloween yet, but Christmas things are out.
Oh, yes, it's all over.
I thought this was interesting information because, you know, with these various charities that we know so well, and incidentally, all of the charities are hurting because, you know, the whole world is hurting financially.
Yeah.
But it will be interesting to know that of the ones that we that are very popular, I want to tell you what portion of your dollar go really towards the cause itself. For UNICEF, it's 14% or 14 cents of the dollar that actually goes to the cause. The rest of the dollar goes for administration and salaries. The American Red Cross, it is 39 cents out of the dollar. And this is according to the Posted News. Not me, so just do your research yourself. For United Way, it's 51 cents of the dollar.
Oh.
For World Vision, it is 52 cents. Hmm. But this is the one that I'm excited about. For the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
For the Salvation Army, 93 cents of your dollar goes towards the cause. Because the Salvation Army's commissioner, who then at the time of this report was Todd Bassett, he receives a salary of only $13,000 per year,
well,
plus housing, for managing this $2 billion organization.
Hmm.
So 93 cents of every dollar given to the Salvation Army really goes to the poor and the needy. So Christmas is a time when you always see the Salvation Army with their pot and the bell.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that true?
Yes, it is true.
So as you go to the supermarket and the different places and you give your dollar, just give yourself a big pat on the back and smile. Because 93 cents of that dollar is going right where it should. So, think twice before you give and who you give to.
Sure.
And
yeah.
You know what the short name for the thrift store that has some marvelous things for people on a budget, especially with children,
yeah,
that outgrow their clothes so fast. It's called Sally Ann. That's what the thrift stores are called, Sally Ann. So I just thought I'd share that with
but
our.
They also take donation.
Oh yes,
and furniture and things.
Right,
like that.
Right. But I thought that was interesting, so I thought I'd share it with everybody because I know the holidays are coming up and they're usually early out with their bell and their pot.
Yes, yeah, especially at the mall.
Yes, yes, yes. And here in Atlanta, where I live, always at the supermarkets.
Oh, I haven't seen them at the supermarket, but at the mall, at every entrance, they're
uh-huh.
always standing there ready to open the door and, you know, ringing the bell. And
Right. And I want to remind our listeners that we did a marvelous show on the how it started in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of the listeners on the board or online miss that, you can go in the archives and check it out. I don't remember what month we did it, but it is getting a lot of hits on the internet. So it's an interesting story of how it started in Jamaica. Do you remember that, fans? Do you remember discussing
yes.
that?
Yes, I do.
I just think that was such an inspiring story because there was such differences in the people
right.
who actually got together and started it.
Right.
So, as usual, we love to bring alive stories of the past that are positive and that help us celebrate our heritage here in the backyard. So I want to thank all our listeners on the board, those listening online, and those who may come by later to listen to the show. I want you to remind you that there are lots of interesting shows. If you just check on your left, I think, or right, you will see the shows are listed by the month. Just scroll down and pick one you like and listen to it while you check your email or surf the net or do something else, whatever you do online. And if you find a show that tweaks your interest, send it to someone else that you think may be interested or tell your friends. We thank you for visiting us here in the backyard, where we lavish each week at 8 o'clock, and we ask you to come often and tell your friends. Bring your friends along and ask them to select their favorite chair and transport themselves to the beautiful island of Jamaica where the trade winds are always blowing after. Is it a special time that it starts to blow, Lay, or just anytime after dark or what? You know anything about the trade winds movement across the island?
Well, you know, there are certain times that it's it's not only cooler, but it's stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And
the wind
that
is
relates
stronger.
I think the fall period.
Yeah, coming up to
yeah,
the holidays.
Coming up the December, November, December months.
Yeah.
I remember that because I used to swim in my younger days, and in the evenings around 6 o'clock when the sun was going down, I used to get chills.
Mm.
So
it's the time. Yeah,
yep.
Because during that time you would need a sweater or something if you're going out, or a shawl.
Right.
At night.
Yep.
Well, a lot of things might have changed on the island, but I know that the weather more or less remains the same. Am I correct?
Well, except for the kind of rains that they're getting nowadays. People say that they haven't seen the likes of it.
Oh, really? Because of the change, we're having more hurricanes or something?
Well, it seems like it's worldwide that we're getting more...
Right.
...rains and flooding and this and that. Indonesia just got hit twice in the last couple of days with an earthquake and a volcano.
Tsunami.
Tsunami.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just makes us know how grateful we are, should be, when we are able to do, do whatever we do. Because right now, as we speak, there are so many people all over the world that are displaced for one reason or the next. So
our next bus is Haiti, and look at what they're having.
Right. Now they're into an epidemic. So we need to start being grateful for just being able to have this hour together, even though we're in different locations all over the world or all over the country or a country. We live in a time now where we can all get together in a virtual backyard all at the same time and communicate, and I think we should be embracing it and celebrating it and be grateful for it. I know I am. So I hope you all you will join me in just being thankful. And this week, one of my goals is to be grateful and not to complain. So I challenge my listeners this week, every time they find themselves grumbling or complaining, just remember that you have so much to be thankful for. Because as we speak, there are countless people all over the world, including our island, that is in a much less fortunate situation than we are. So with that said, my loyal fans, I appreciate you and thank you for being with me, and I bid you good night. And I remind the listeners once more that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock, and we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica. All together now,
and we love.
Thank you all for being here. And with that said, I'm going to close like I always do when I say, make it a great week. Good night.
Good night. God bless. Bye.
Thank you.